how are we going, what are we going to address, how are we, or are we going to address anything at all, or what are we, what timeframe is, is that what you're wanting to discuss?
Yes, I would like to pick up on some of the comments that Trish and Dave made, but I'm hearing an additional question on the subject matter, so I'm turning to you to say, what's your wish?
Well, that's a difficult question. I guess my wish would be that I think we need to make a decision probably on the process first. Because if the decision is to go ahead and discuss this matter today and tomorrow, then that question is appropriate. If the decision is, well, okay, we've got these alternate proposals, let's all go back and digest them, look at them, and then set up a work session in 2 weeks, that means that question can wait, right? And Dave can further develop that or talk to the council and others, right? So I guess the process question may be the first one to discuss. Anyone disagree with that? Okay.
I, too, think that with the agenda, I would like to discuss the idea of rearranging the agenda so that we have some work session time while we're together here. Because I think what I've begun to think is that I'm in a dilemma in terms of, do I believe that we should put our energy into sub-proposals or comprehensive proposals? When we originally formed our short-term and our long-term list, as a committee, I think our philosophy was that we were going to take all three pieces. And I think what's really going on here is that we are thinking that we still may be able to come up with some sense of how we feel about a comprehensive package in the next 6 weeks or in a shorter time frame. And so in that regard, I'm certainly willing to focus the energy on that, and with the understanding and the expectation that we will not fail as a task force if we don't reach something in the time frame that we've established. We can always go back then and look at some of these other proposals or concurrently endorse some of them. But we need a process for doing that, and I'd like to start that process as soon as possible. So I'm not sure if I'm clear here, but what I'm saying is that for myself, I'm reorienting my thinking to, it's okay to go ahead and try to do something comprehensive in the short term. That's a little different than we had on the list previously. And that we ought to set a deadline, and we ought to agree on a process for how to do that.
I'm not in disagreement. In fact, maybe I haven't been making myself clear. That's what I would like to do. And I think I've discussed this with Representative Ellis last evening, and I think we're in concurrence on that. We set a time frame. We set up a process. We set a time frame. And if we can't reach a consensus on a comprehensive proposal by a certain date, that doesn't mean we failed. It means we got a lot more work to do. But out of that process that we work over the next 6 to 8 weeks, some, and I hate to use the term short term, because I don't think any of these proposals are short term. I think they're there for the long term. It just may be that they're more immediately done. They're easier to do. They're less controversial. They're not as comprehensive, but they're not short term solutions. So if we just take certificate of need, for example, if we could get agreement that everybody was under certificate of need, sounds like we could move that bill. We could move that proposal. That's not a short-term solution, but it's something that can be done immediately. So I get uncomfortable with the term short-term versus long-term. It's like if something is going to go away, it's not going to go away. So I guess I would look for suggestions from the committee. I'm willing to commit my time over the next 2 months, as much time as I have, and it probably means weekend work. To have work sessions of committee of the whole, everyone, and with the starting point being that we look at what 83 does and what other bills do and what the Cost Containment Council is saying, and we try to come together on the points that we can to begin providing improved access, universal care, cost containment, and so on. I don't think it's impossible to do something this session.
Do you think it's possible that we perhaps start that work, with an initial work session tomorrow, while we have the advantage of having Larry here? If we decide we want two or three work groups, that we maybe don't encumber everybody with the enormity of the numbers in this group, that Larry would be here to facilitate and being able to float back and forth perhaps between two or three work groups that have perhaps some specific tasks in front of them, and maybe get 2 or 3 hours out of tomorrow to initiate that process, which then would go on with a agreed upon deadline of March 15th or whatever. That's what people keep kind of throwing out.
I'm open to any suggestion the committee has. I guess my thoughts were on two points on that. One, it may be unfair to certain people who, looking at our agenda, didn't expect us to go into a work session tomorrow on these proposals. They may not be able to be present. And I don't want to, if the committee says, let's do it anyway, then that's fine. But I don't want to be the one that says that we're going to not do it when everybody is able to participate.
Actually, that was my question a couple, you know, a few minutes ago, was I wasn't sure what time frame these were scheduled for. I wasn't.
And the idea behind this work session, which came up late, actually started last week, started thinking about it, was to schedule it now with everybody here so everybody can be present. The problem that I see, Trish, and maybe the committee should discuss this, you know, there is a lot of rationale and reasoning to break this committee into subcommittees and each of us take a specific area as a work group and work on that for 2 or 3 weeks and then get an answer and come back. The difficulty with that is, with this issue that I see, is that you almost have to have everybody bought into the whole thing at the same time or it falls apart. I mean, we may put together a group on malpractice reform that has Representative Navarro on it and Roxana and Dr. Wilson and so on, and they come up with a great solution, Representative Navarro is a minority, and they bring it back to the table, nobody else likes it. So I just don't want us doing little work groups that spin their wheels forever or do a lot of good work, and then they come back and the full committee says no. I think the way you get a comprehensive approach is all 18 members have to buy off as we go, or it doesn't work.
Well, I guess I see one of the advantages of maybe getting started when we're all here together is that maybe we exercise that control a little bit in terms of we don't let one of these little subgroups get too far away from the main group, but we only let them go away for 2 or 3 hours and then they come back.
Well, maybe Dr. Wilson, then Mantle.
Senator Duncan, I agree that we ought to be a committee on the whole because we have to decide 2 and possibly 3 real big questions if we've been focused on these two documents. One, as Dave says, is the mandatory health insurance versus non-mandatory. And the second is whether we're going to have rate setting or we're not going to have rate setting. And I think the group has to decide both of those two big issues before we can go forward with trying to meld, say, these two documents. And maybe a third one, the issue come up today, is whether we're going to have a part of it that deals with tort reform, and we have to decide that as a group. And I think we ought to do it as a group and not as subcommittees.
Senator Duncan, this is Matt O'Fry, and I absolutely agree with Dr. Wilson and your comments. I appreciate what Trish and Karen have suggested, but the problem with this particular group is that it's a large group, but it's not large enough to really break and divide into subcommittees. That I have an interest, for instance, in every single provision of whatever we ultimately decide on, and I think everyone around the table does. I just don't see how we could break that down into a subcommittee process. The other thing that I think is very important, and I really appreciate the chipper presentation from HACCAC, the Health Access and Cost Containment Council. I appreciate the work that they have done, but we also have asked them many questions. And again, to comment on some of your comments, Senator Duncan, obviously Dr. Christian is leaving, and it's not possible for them over the next day and a half to provide the information that we've really asked of them. And I think it may take a meeting to just spend time on specifically seeing if there are ways that we can dovetail the two proposals that are in front of us now.
Mr. Chair, may you or I ask if Dave Hennigan, who's been very much involved in this, can you be here tomorrow or not?
Yes, I'm scheduled to be here the rest of the week.
And Ray Shallon?
Representative Navarro, then Jay. I'm sorry, Jay.
I guess I agree with what both sides have said. First of all, even groups this size, the task that we have before us is no small task. I think we probably ought to try breaking it down and having some work groups. And I would just assume not be on the liability for the panel. And the only reason I say that is because I don't want it to be tainted. There are people, regardless of efforts that have been made in the past, who feel that I won't be objective on that issue, although, of course, I feel that I'm always objective. and I'll have plenty of opportunities both at this level. What the legislature does, and the Senate's about this side of the body, is you break it down. People come in, they discuss it, they iron it out, and if they then come back to the group and they lay it out there and everybody looks at it and they discuss it, say, this is good, it cuts down on the amount of discussion that the group as a whole has to go through. Otherwise, every single issue we deal with, we're going to be discussing as a group of the whole, and we've got a long ways to go and a short time to get there.
So, I got here. What were you suggesting?
I'm suggesting we try to break it down.
How does that avoid the whole group rediscussing the issue?
Well, it doesn't except that you refine it a little bit. It's sort of like the committee process, Jim, where it goes to a committee and the committee deals. I mean, we could set up committees and it goes to different committees, and then when it goes to the floor, someone is able to argue, usually the committee chairman or the people on the committee are able to argue the particular issue that you tried to refine at the committee level.
Okay.
I'm sorry. We're going to try a little different approach on this. And this, just to throw this out on the table for discussion, I'm not sure if anybody will agree with it. What if we broke down into committees, but instead of dealing with functional areas in these, such as tort reform, such as access, such as cost containment, what if each group was to deal with the comprehensive issue? And then you come back to the table with different approaches, because I don't think we want to separate these issues into their component pieces. We're trying to come up with a comprehensive proposal. But by breaking up into groups that are looking at, and each group looking at the comprehensive issue, then you have more of a chance for discussion among group members putting together proposals. And I think we need to give specific instructions to each of the groups, and one of those instructions may be figure out what the philosophical similarities are between what's on the table and what are the philosophical differences, and come to some kind of a conclusion about those as a group, and begin to think about even putting together different combinations of packages, but keeping the comprehensive ideas the responsibility of each group.
I think I understand the suggestion. Sister Don?
Senator, my suggestion was, I guess, somewhat along those lines. Maybe there are some real key issues that we need to pull out, such as the ones that Rod has raised, and discuss as a group, come to conclusion as a group on, and then the other maybe less central issues give to small committees.
Mr. Chairman, Rod Wilson, could Larry overnight reduce this to the issues that we must talk about as a group, and the ones that are similar, we sort of agreed on, not waste a lot of time on.
This is Larry Bartlett. I guess I've been listening to the discussion. It sort of breaks down in a couple of different ways. I think you've got two proposals out on the table that differ significantly in many respects, but are similar at least in terms of the model or the structure they attempt to use to address many of the problems in the system, and I think that's a real plus. Again, I sort of came away from this morning's discussion thinking that there's an awful lot of similarity between the two. You could certainly wait until the other group sort of took their next iteration, but in some way you might look at it as the ball being in your court, and I think they've given you enough to sort of stimulate your discussion and say, well, do we have, you know, is one of these better than the other, or maybe there's a third approach to addressing this issue. I'd be happy to take a shot at laying those things out. It seems to me that while the structure is the same, the two areas are the ones that Dave focused on, in terms of the degree and the mechanisms for controlling costs, not just dealing with prices, and the flip side, and one is maybe stronger than the other in that respect, and the other one is access. And again, it may be sort of a differential relationship there, but I think the question that's on the table too is, when do you start doing that? Whether you start doing it sometime tomorrow, or you wait for a next meeting of a small group. And maybe that's the kind of thing that both small groups, if you were to break into a small group today, tomorrow, whenever, both of you could address that central structure of 83 or the council's proposal. I'd be happy to try to put down something on paper. It may not be the most helpful guidance, but it may move things along.
Secretary,
I'm not sure if it's at all, because I've been going through two major one suggested, presumably a package of suggested legislation yet to be drafted, another bill. I'm not sure that to some extent that 73 and 74, which I don't wish to address today, I'm not prepared to address today, but they may to some extent at least some of the proposed today of this issue here that are addressed in that package of legislation.
And,
I'm not sure it shouldn't at least be on the table. I've withheld until now comments from last year, but I'm not sure it shouldn't be, at least shouldn't be looked at.
And there was no intention, Senator, not to to bring concepts in your proposal?
No, no, I knew there wasn't. No, I knew there wasn't.
And, that
and as you know, with the pressures of this time, I'm glad to be here, but I can't be here.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, would it be all right then, Senator Katula, if Larry had 73 and 74, which I'm sure he already has, and keep that in mind while you're doing this, too, if that's the instructions from the chair for, or the wish of the body for it to go this direction.
Well, based on what I'm hearing, maybe this is what we should do, because we're, you know, we can spin our wheels on this forever today, too. Maybe we should ask Larry to spend some time this evening and maybe tomorrow morning even if be necessary for you. I don't know how much time it is, but to lay out from his view what an approach could be that the task force could take and begin to proceed addressing this issue on a comprehensive basis and make some recommendations, bring it back to task force, we can then discuss that approach. I don't know, I'm still not clear in my mind exactly how it works when you break down into the subcommittees and subgroups. I guess I know how the committee process works in the legislature, and I think I know how the committee process works in the legislature. That works sometimes, but when you're dealing with smaller groups and you're not dealing with the various interest groups that we have represented here. I'm not sure this committee, my concern is that once you bring back a subcommittee report, you've got a long ways to go yet. And that when you plowed that ground through a subcommittee, you might as well be plowing it with all 18 people at the table. Because I think subcommittee approach is just meant to... I just think it would cause a lot of going over and over and over and over the same ground and the same territory. So I think we need to think about that, too. Seems to me you've got to have all people together or you don't get an answer to this question. And I'm looking at the table. Do we not divide it down this side or that side? And, you know, it's going to be tough to get balance on these subcommittees, probably. Karen?
I could see it would be useful whether we break into one or two groups or in talking about what Larry would be writing up, would almost be like a worksheet or a really asking us questions about central elements, taking what he knows and then translating those into questions that we have to answer in the group, which then allows us to shop from the various proposals that are out there in answering our questions. To me, I would find that as a useful mechanism for, I think I would anyway, for moving forward. And then there might be some insurance that you could work in smaller groups for some of the issues. It may be that what we would see from that list is that there are several active things that have to be talked about together. I frankly believe that you could maybe subcommittee some of the other issues. But maybe it wouldn't be a committee. I don't know. I mean, one of the things is people have to be willing to work on things in subcommittees.
Benefits packages, another one that could be.
So, I realize we're kind of in flux here, but I'm feeling
let's let Larry do some work. How's that? And come back to the task force tomorrow.
Poor change.
The guy's been hanging around. Let him do some work and come back to task force, and then we can make some decisions there. I mean, you know. Whatever, I just think we need to keep the process moving forward, and let's make a committee decision somehow tomorrow to decide what's the best way to go. For example, I think Roger brought up a good point. He says we got to decide one of the topics might be benefit package. Well, in my mind, do we? Or do we say, no, we don't design a benefit package, we let the authority design the benefit package, right? So you might be able to, if you make that first basic decision, then you may not have to spend a lot of time on a benefit design, right? So there's a lot of, it's not going to be an easy process. Roxanna wants to say something.
Just a real quick comment. I know for myself that a lot of the discussion will take place because I almost feel like we're going to discuss it and present our point of view, and I feel like we're almost building right to the point of almost taking a vote, and we never do it. And I think that that's where I'm steered wrong sometimes, too, in this process, that as we're going through these point by point, I think we're getting the conversation around the task force, and we are presenting our views, but then we stop right at the peak. And some of these items I do think that we could maybe vote on and then just put it aside, and we won't keep hounding on it.
That's the goal of the work sessions, is to bring us past a point of just being fed, right? And we all discuss it, give our views, but to really get it down and finally at some point make a decision. And it takes it off the table, or it incorporates it as a package, or we make a decision that, you know, we do need a business package, we don't, whatever. I agree with you. That's frustrating to just get to the edge and then say, okay, now let's go somewhere else because we don't make a hard decision. And I want to try to force the task force to point to make those decisions. Okay, any other questions? I think then what, if it's okay, and we're going to break here in a few moments, but if it's okay, instead of going on with this discussion, we'll ask Larry to lay out some suggestions, and we'll come back to this topic tomorrow morning, if possible, Larry, if we can do it first thing in the morning, so we can, and then we can make a determination of what we need to do for the next day and a half. And at the same time, you know, when we decide how we're going to handle this, whether it's through subcommittee or big group, I am also thinking we need to set up a time frame, a very firm time frame, to keep the committee moving. So I hope you'll be thinking about that. Larry, do you have any other comments? Is this impossible? Does this interfere with anything you're planning tonight?
No, not at all. No, I think that actually I had in mind much of the structure that Karen just mentioned. I was really excited about the notion of a side-by-side. I might try to do the same with maybe a little different tact on it, and maybe have this is just my initial thoughts, a third column with some of the issues that I might identify, that some of the questions that need to be resolved, and perhaps a fourth blank column if people want to take these things, and whether it's in small groups or whatever, just somehow jot their own thoughts down once you sort of work through that process. And in particular, if you've got two small groups going, you can come back and try to put them together, save a little time.
Dave, do you have a question?
I'll volunteer my assistance to Larry.
Sure. Trish, have we kind of answered your concerns best we can right now?
Yes.
Oh, boy. I was hoping you'd say yes.
You said right now.
Right now, yeah. Right now.
Oh. I'm taking you very literally.
Okay. All right. What we're going to do, we need to talk about the agenda anymore? Here's what I had in mind for the rest of the day. Take a break. We're going to take a break, and then Mr. Pesca has agreed to move from tomorrow to today to talk about the uncompensated care question. And then tomorrow morning's agenda. Jeff, what's your schedule? Since you're here, we don't want you leaving without having an opportunity.
Senator, if I don't get on the plane tomorrow at 6:59, my wife's going to kill me. that's the only constraint that I have.
We'll get you on the plane.
You have good coverage?
Okay, well, whatever. We'll work it out so that you have your opportunity tomorrow before, so you make your plane. But you'd prefer to wait till tomorrow anyway, I understand.
I'm at the pleasure of the committee. I can submit the material that I've gotten and answer whatever questions the committee may have, save a little time on the data piece that way.
Why don't we plan on doing this? Taking a break, letting Mr. Pesca go ahead, and then tomorrow morning we'll lead off the discussion with Larry and then follow up with you. How's that? Okay? Is that okay with everyone? 10-minute break? 10-minute break, and we'll... Okay, we have Gary Pesca is going to make a presentation on the Alaska, representing the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, I guess, on uncompensated care. We'd ask that be done for this meeting, and Gary has been working on that report. Again, just so the committee keep things in mind, my goal would be to try to adjourn before 4:30. It's been a long day, so if we can keep that in mind. Okay, Gary?
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gary Pesca. I'm here representing the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association, and I'll do everything I can to make this go fast. A little over a month ago, this task force asked the association to help by gathering some financial data from the members of the hospital association. I've distributed a package of responses to the committee members, and I'll go through that very quickly here. The questions that we asked our members by survey were, how much did you have in charity care, bad debts, and Hilbert and free care? What were your revenues at the pool charge? And what were your allowances or discounts broken down by payer? What were your operating costs? And separate depreciation out and state that as a separate item. What were your other sources of operating revenue, such as state revenue sharing or taxes from local sources? And what was your outstanding debt and your annual debt service? And that was a question that was asked by a member of the task force. We also asked for a brief description of the type of debt, tax exempt, taxable, et cetera. We sent out questionnaires at the beginning of December. We sent out another set of questionnaires toward the end of December and followed up by phone calls to the members. We got 16 responses. All of the largest hospitals in the state did respond. The first table, which is the third page of your packet, it's called table number one, is simply a list of the facilities that responded to this questionnaire, listed in order of their size by total charges for the year. By the way, this data that we gathered was for their fiscal year ended during calendar year 1990. Table number one shows that we had total charges during that year of $403,371,764 for these 16 respondents, and that of that, $317,239,050 was actually collected. That difference, I've tried to be a little bit careful about what I call that, because this term uncompensated care seems to get bantered around a lot. I've simply said that is the unpaid charges for services. Bills went out for that amount and did not get paid. That total is $86,132,714. If you'll look now at chart one, which is the first pie chart on page four of your packet, that represents the total $86 million worth of unpaid services. It shows bad debts, charity care, Hilbert and free care, and all the discounts and allowances taken by other payers, such as Medicaid, Medicare, and Champus, and et cetera. Chart number one indicates that 36.79% of the unpaid charges in 1990 was due to the Medicaid reimbursement rate. 23.82% was due to the Medicare reimbursement rate. 17.53% was from bad debts, and you can follow the chart on around and see what the other factors involved there were. Moving on to chart number two, which is the fifth page in your packet, that breaks down the items that represent only charity, bad debts, and Hilbert and free care. For these 16 facilities, that total was $22,210,884. You see in the chart there that bad debts represented 67.98% of that total. Charity care represented 24.56%, and Hilbert and Free Care was 7.46%. Now, I should tell you that, or I guess just reiterate what I said at the last meeting, and that is that we've discovered that there are lots of inconsistencies from facility to facility in how they keep their records. Some of the facilities have more charity care than they've reported to me. The data simply is not readily available in their records. I got the best data that I could here, but you'll notice as you go through the individual worksheets that some of the large facilities even list unavailable under the caption charity care.
Karen, I can't tell the colors here. What's the 7.46?
I'm sorry about that. I was working off the original and it had nice shaded gray section. The 7.46% is Hilbert and free care. The 67.98% is bad debts, and charity care is the 24.56.
And then the previous chart, what are the shades of gray? Chart number one, could you
do that? On the previous chart, Medicaid is the 36.79%. Medicare is the 23.82%. And they go right on around the pie in order clockwise. At the very top, you'll notice I show 1.92%. That actually reflects the Hill-Burton percentage of this total, and I couldn't fit the percentage in my computer program over Champus. It just simply didn't have enough room. That's also about 2%. But this total is 100% of the unpaid charges for services.
Gary, could you explain to me, maybe I'm the only one that doesn't know this, but the Hilbert Free Care, explain that to me. How does that come about? Exactly what is that?
I'll make a stab at that, and I hope David Hennigan will please help me if I say something wrong here. Hilbert and Free Care is related to hospitals that got federal funds when their hospital was constructed. They then have a responsibility to provide a certain amount of free care to eligible recipients below a certain level of income. If you're above that level of income, but you still, or assets maybe, but you still don't have the funds to pay for your hospital care, then you're called charity care. Hilbert has certain federal criteria in terms of level of income, but it's related to construction of the hospital.
So based on percentage of cost, the construction cost or Hilbert, I mean, how much does a hospital have to provide? I mean, is there a...
That I'd have to turn to maybe Dave can help me.
I think the period of time is 10 years. You have a total obligation that you repay in the form of free care extended over a period of 10 years. I believe that's the criteria. In the case of Providence, we've exhausted our or met the Hilbert obligation a long time ago, and so I don't have the exact regulations on
to pay on some of their debt.
Mr. Chairman, Ed Mon from Ketchikan is here.
I like the finance guy from Bradley. We both have the same program, but the number of countries know better than the units. You take the amount of the grant, 10% of the amount of the grant, then inflated forward, is your annual obligation. So you take the amount of the grant times 10%, and then inflate that forward, and you have to provide that level of care for 20 years. Is the amount of this obligation to go through. And the test to qualify for Hilbert is an income test. It doesn't include assets. It includes just the income.
Dave
Walsh.
Thank you, Mr. Hunter. This is Dave Walsh. So then in terms of our calculations about what we can do to help this situation, basically Hilbert really ought to be listed as debt retirement because that's what it is. It's like getting a 20-year loan from the feds that you repay in kind.
The loan does not need to be paid off in addition to that?
No. You pay your loan off, as I understand it, through free care. I mean, is that right, or am I missing something?
Yes. Why don't you identify yourself?
My name is Ed Mon, Minister of Ketchikan General Hospital. The Hilbert program, I know it from two facets. One, when I lived in Montana, I administered the program for hospitals. I'm not the hospital administrator, I get the benefits, sort of. But in terms of when the program was originally established in 1948, then amended in 1952, and then it was 56, the program initially was just a straight grant to communities because we wanted to build health care facilities. There were no strings attached to it at all. There was no, when you took that money, there was no expectation for some of the hospitals that were built in the 60s that they'd have to pay it back. I think it was in the mid-70s that the government changed their mind and said that for accepting the money, you'll have to make give free care an amount of the loan over a 20-year period and prepay that if you got more charity care. So what a lot of hospitals did, you know, we had a lot of charity care, so they just prepaid it and got out of the obligation quicker. But it was not a loan program per se when it was set up.
Okay, but if I may, Mr. Chairman, but this 36.79%, was this stuff that was tacked on? In other words, did hospitals take this federal money in 1970 with no strings attached, and then all of a sudden in 1976 have the strings attached for that prior money, or does this 36% represent the requirements for funds taken after 1976 when this program went in?
I imagine that 36% came from our facility, our poor share of Hilbert. It's for that this is our this year's obligation for 1965. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, may I help here a second? Excuse me, David. The Hilbert is 1.92%.
Okay.
The 36.79% is the portion of unpaid due to Medicaid reimbursement.
But to answer your question, that amount we report is that year's obligation. It doesn't go all the way back. It's just that we have an obligation that you've got to give so much.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. I didn't understand. Okay. Go ahead, Gary.
Yes. I'll just finish up here briefly. on chart number 3, I thought that the task force might be interested in that breakdown of that number called other unpaid discounts or allowances. And if you'll take a look at chart number 3, the last pie chart in your package, you'll see that that amount breaks down by 49.58% being Medicaid related. The Medicare portion is 32.09%. Others is an item that some of the facilities just dumped in unspecified, and I had no choice but to plug it someplace, and I plugged it in this column called Others at 15.29%. And Champus, which is really hard to see on this copy of the pie chart, is 3.04%. Also, as I mentioned, the task force members and staff expressed interest in the facility's cost to charges ratio. If you'll look at the individual facility worksheets that follow these charts, you'll notice that on line 16 of each facility worksheet, you'll see a calculation of the cost to charges for each facility. I did not present this in graphic form because as you go through these worksheets, you'll see that the numbers are all over the board. Some of them are substantially over 100%. Some of them are substantially under. And there's really no trend that I could show in a graphic way. If you look at line 14 of the facility worksheets, you'll see the answers regarding your questions, or the answers to your questions regarding outstanding debt. Line 14A says, what was your total outstanding debt? Line 14B says, what kind of debt was it if you had some outstanding debt? And then line 15 breaks down where the debt service payments came from during 1990. In some cases, municipalities kick in a portion of the debt service, and you'll see that on the line called local government, directly under line 15B. If the facility paid the debt service itself, it's on line 15A.
Question. Maybe you've answered this. I'm just trying to read this chart. I'm back at Bartlett Hospital, first one.
Just to pick a random example.
Well, it happened to be first.
It's in alphabetical order.
It's in alphabetical order.
Yes. Right.
I just want to be sure I understand this now. What you're showing in column A is revenues at the full charge rate. That's assuming that if everybody paid what charge is for the service, that's what they would receive. What that B shows then is that Medicaid, Medicare, Indian Health Service are paying less than full charge. I mean, we've known that all along, but that clearly shows that, right? That they have capped their charges for some reason.
Yes, sir. That's
what they'll pay for the charges for some reason. I'm trying to figure out what happens then. That totals $2,498,000, including bad debts and Hilbert and free care. So without those two, it's about $1 million of discounted covered care, right?
Yes.
Hospitals eat that?
I'm sorry, what?
Do they just eat that? Hospitals absorb that? What's happened?
As Jay Leiby discussed this morning, it's really hard to tell because in the case of Medicaid, the rates that are set in your rate year are based on actual information from 2 years before. So I believe if we did these charts over a period of time, like 5 years, we would see that there were some years where the hospitals actually had an excess of reimbursement over their Medicaid-related costs, and there would be other years when their costs would be higher than their Medicaid reimbursement. And again, it's because of this lag in the time between which the rate gets set the time between which the rate is based and it actually gets set. So in answer to your question, do the hospitals eat that? Maybe, but I can't tell for sure without looking at this over a longer period of time than just 1 year.
Jay?
Yeah, Gary, my other question is, what the information shows is what the revenues are at the full charge rate, but it doesn't say anything about what the cost is.
Well, only in the sense, Jay, that, no, it does not break costs down by payer. It only shows the total cost on line 12A. It shows the facility's total cost. Right. And I use that line 12A to calculate the cost to charge ratio. So if you assume it's the same for every payer, then you have it.
Right.
Gary, in line 12A, does that include debt service?
The interest portion of debt service.
Okay.
Let me ask you one other question so I understand. Now looking at line 10, which is a private payer, or looking at Blue Cross. through Cross Commercial Insurance and paid by patient shows no discount. But I assume there's no discount there, but I'm assuming that $1,000,005 comes from those three lines, right? Going back to the top, the bad debt line comes from those three lines. Is that correct?
Yes, that's
primarily from line 10.
That's correct. That's correct. Bad debts, by definition, would come from the private pay line.
So can I make the assumption then that a third of the charges billed to private payers are unpaid at Bartlett? 33% uncollectible?
I guess as long as Garth is right here, I'd like to ask him to answer that question, but I would say that's probably the case. There may be some timing differences here where bad debts are from 1 year are being written off against revenues in the following year, but maybe Garth would like to...
Probably not all of it. There's a lot of people have insurance that don't pay the deductible and co-insurance portion. They also become bad debt. State employee that comes in and decides not to pay the co-insurance and deductible. Well,
state employee wouldn't do that.
Medicare patients, there's a deductible and co-insurance portion of their bill. Some of them don't pay that. So that also is written as bad debt. But the majority, certainly the 80-20 rule
So are you saying then, as a rule of thumb, 20% of the private payers' charges are uncollectible? I just was trying to get an idea here what the problem is. Okay. Any other questions? Robert, did you have a question?
Yeah. My last comment.
Karen, did you have a question?
You can wait.
My last comment, Mr. Chairman, is simply that in looking at these individual worksheets for the facilities, I noted that 9 of the 16 respondents had operating costs that exceeded their ordinary net operating revenue during 1990. That would imply they all had a loss, except if you take a look at Seward's worksheets, you'll see that they get a substantial local subsidy to make up for their loss. Again, though, I have to reiterate that that loss might be made up by a profit 2 years in 1992. Because if they experienced a loss in 1990, the Medicaid rate system is designed to make that up in 1992. That's all the comments I had. I'd be happy to.
Mr. Chairman, question. You said this is 16 of the 26 institutions, but includes the biggest. Do you have a feel for what proportion of the total beds or the hospital bed year or annual hospital bed, occupied beds this would represent?
I do not. Scott Goldsmith was here. He might be able to tackle that from his work with the Medicaid Rate Advisory Commission's records.
Scott, have you thought about what percentage we're looking at for the 16?
No, I haven't had a chance to go through and eyeball it. Acute care facilities is probably at least 2/3, 3/4. Yeah, 4 largest areas.
Senator Robley-Walden, I have a question probably of the hospital administrators. If this 17% that is being paid by the patient and then the 6% that is not being paid, and as you say, primarily that's from the private payers, although it's some combination of stuff. If there were a good insurance plan available to these private payers, and these so that your bad debt percentage and amount decreased significantly, would you have a decrease in cost to patients at the hospital? If I could just ask the reverse of that, how much increased cost do you have because of the bad debt? The full amount, more?
No, you don't have any increase in cost nor decrease in cost. Remember, I said earlier, we have in the healthcare delivery system now the de facto tax. It's called the cost shifting. Mm-hmm. What we do right now, effectively, is increase the charges to the others that are able to pay so that those who can't can have coverage from the healthcare.
Okay, that's my question, though. If everybody is paying,
then you should be able to reduce the cost to everyone.
That's exactly right. That's why you say it's mandatory that we, that everybody is in. That way the pool of people that are paying is spread more uniformly, so the cost comes down.
So that if through this SB 83 or some other plan, there's a good health insurance available to all residents of Alaska, would you then say that hospital costs should be decreased by 6%, by 10%, by, do you have an idea?
You'd have a redistribution of the health care premiums so that the, let's say for the sake of example, the plan pays $350 a month, or in the case of Jennifer's example, she said $3,000 of the cost of health care on an annual basis. That includes the cost of uncompensated care, 6%. So if everyone was being reimbursed, that $3,000 would come down. It wouldn't have an effect on the hospital.
I don't really understand why not. If you have generated $1.2 million in revenue, that you would not have been getting under this scenario, why wouldn't the cost per patient go down? It would, wouldn't it?
No, because the cost of providing that health care is on the line of the schedule. The charges to the people include, in effect, charges for the people that aren't able to pay. So if I have health insurance, I'm paying more because others aren't able to pay. The cost has no effect. Where the cost is affected is in the insurance market. That's where it's affected, not the cost.
Let me just, you're asking, I think, a very good question. Let me just be more specific. Forget about the insurance rate. This goes back to Dave's question about how the mechanics would work, how the dynamics would work in the system. If you suddenly wipe out bad debt and charity care, and let's just make some general assumptions, by providing coverage to all, that should be reflected not in a reduction in costs, but in a reduction in your overall charge rate. And I think the question that, which is, I think we were just getting a little confused between costs and charges here. That is a question that in just about every other state that we've worked in where we've discussed this, the question that comes up from the policymakers, how do we know we're going to see that? How do we know that if we do something on the access side that there would in fact be this clear offset or reduction in terms of charge levels? I think that was the question that you were asking. Yeah, I guess that was in some ways either a rhetorical question or a real question in the sense of how one of the questions I think we have to address is how you make that happen. How, if you in fact reduce unsponsored or unpaid for care, how that would come about. That I guess that in a sense we're talking about that 5% reduction, at least on the hospital side, would be something that you would expect not in terms of any discount for any other reasons other than a reduction in terms of due to the reduction in uncompensated care. Dave, would that be in the ballpark there?
Is there further response needed? Dr. Garth, are you?
Huh? Rob Wilson, the 5% discount was not just on hospital area, it was for outpatient doctors, doctors too.
But if this is Larry Bartlett again, if this proposal were to, in fact, eliminate the uninsured and underinsured, you would expect that the 5% wouldn't be, that it would be, theoretically, there would be an ability within the hospital industry, just on this factor alone, all other things being equal, to reduce their rates by that 5 or 6%, not just for plan members, but across the board. And again, I think that's when you get down to implementation and all, then the question comes up, how do you ensure, how do you work through the process of seeing that reduction in terms of future cost and future charge increase actually does accrue to citizens of the state.
Karen?
When I look at mine, column D, I just want to make sure I understand what I'm looking at. Which, let's look at commercial insurance, which is on line 9. And most of the acute care hospitals look like 100%, 99.9%, 98%, whatever. What we're saying here is that all commercial insurers that do business in the hospital are paying the full charge?
Well, at least in this worksheet we have in front of us, in part, that appears to be the case, yes. If you look at the next one, Denali, there is a discount,
but
it's fairly small.
But let's look at acute care. Most of them are, in looking at acute care, it's all up in the 99, 98.
That's probably true. I haven't looked at it that way, but I know that numbers are very high.
Does that make sense to you?
I don't know how those allowances are negotiated, and somebody else should probably tackle that other than me.
I could try.
Sure.
I believe that it's been true that the insurance company pays up to that limit, that percent of what their contract says they will pay for whatever the condition is. The patient's responsible for anything above beyond what the contract doesn't provide for.
Okay, so Jerry, you don't think it means that if the charge is $800 a day, that all commercial insurers are paying $800 a day and Medicaid's only paying $650 a day? Because that's what it says to me. That's what it says. Does that make sense?
Well, Mr. Chairman, maybe I can shed some light on this just by saying that what we asked for here from the facilities was your total charges and then the amount that you collected on those charges. Now, again, if I could turn to Dave, he might be able to tell me whether or not there's some bad debts that the facilities might have reported as bad debt instead of commercial insurance discounts, but I tried to stay away from that. Dave, is that possible?
Yeah, I can explain it as an example. If we were to look at profit and the manner in which we report the revenues and the full charge rate, we report the revenues that when you come to the hospital and if you say you have Blue Cross, then we report you and carry you under the Blue Cross label until the point in time Blue Cross pays. After that point in time, balance of your account, say you have a $200 deductible and you owe some co-insurance, the balance is then put in a self-pay category or the private pay category. So effectively, Blue Cross pays up to the maximum policy limits, then the funds are transferred into self-pay status. And that's what Garth was saying earlier. Sometimes people don't pay the deductible co-insurance. So it's a matter of how it's reported on the reports. But essentially, the insurance pays 100% of what the plan design calls for. After that, it's up to the patient to pay the remaining balance.
So Dave, looking at Providence then, if I could just, maybe I was talking to Ms. Part of it, but looking at Providence and taking the Blue Cross line, that's Blue Cross is here, taking the Blue Cross line 8, revenues, the full charge rate for Blue Cross, $6,500,000. Contract allowances, discounts, $975. Is that $975 due to a preferred provider agreement, or is it a discount because their policy only covers up to a certain charge level?
In the case of Providence, the amount reflected under the allowance, that's reflected due to a negotiated contract.
So it's a
preferred provider.
Preferred provider arrangement with Blue Cross.
Right.
And for that, for line 10, it's what? What causes that discount?
Line 10, $1,299,000.
Yeah, paid by patient. What does that discount represent? That's not a preferred provider arrangement.
No, it isn't. It's a combination of numerous things, but for example, there's on $180 million in revenue, there's a point at which time the balance of the account is not economically worth the effort to bill. So, for example, any balance less than $5 is automatically written off. It goes into this account. And there's probably 50 individual examples where that would apply.
variety of reasons.
So those are not really discounts, and that's why I guess I'm asking the question, shouldn't they then appear under the bad debt line, or is there double counting?
Technically, yeah, that would be correct. It could be, some of it could be bad debt, some of it could be voluntary waivers of the bill, because $5 is just not economically worth billing. So it's not truly a bad debt.
Just not paid.
Mr. Chairman, I think the difference might be from a management point of view that Dave would be held responsible for collecting bad debts, but this other list of items that gets dumped into this account is a policy decision that's made by the hospital not to administratively try to collect that.
That's true.
Okay. That's an awful lot of accounts
of
$5 and whack.
Let me ask.
No, that was one example.
I know. I was just kidding.
Dave, again, this question about, let's say the rate's $800 a day. I don't know what it is. So let's say it is in Providence. Is this telling me that commercial insurers pay 99.48% of that $800 and Medicaid paid 51.52% of that $800?
That would be a, I wouldn't accept that.
I am confused because I thought you just said 5 minutes ago that it was 99% of what the policy said they would pay for me, for instance. Hospital room is $800, I check in, my policy has said we'll pay 80% of that. That my Blue Cross in fact paid 80%, which means they met really their total obligation.
100% of their obligation.
But they're not, in fact, paying 100% of my room. They're paying 100% of their obligation. And that's what the 99% is. It's like 99% of their obligation, not of the actual cost to the patient.
Okay.
That's true.
Okay. So there is contractual allowances in commercial insurance reflected in the self-pay or bad debt category if the individual doesn't come up with the cash.
Right. We wouldn't call them contractual allowances. They'd be bad debts or charity. But in the case of Medicaid, for example, the total liability is always due from the
right.
state.
Right. You can't charge the person.
Right.
Okay. Any other questions? Gary, do you have anything further that you wanted to throw out? A lot of good.
Could someone explain what is Indian health care or health service? Number four, line four.
Public health service. U.S. Public Health Service.
Okay, and each hospital provides something.
There's specialized things, one of a kind services that the Indian Health Service doesn't have at their own native hospital or elsewhere that are done in Providence. Isn't that right, Sister?
We do provide some care for the Indian Health Service.
Okay, and then I guess I don't know if it even really pertains that much. I guess I'm just curious because I'm reading through that line of Indian Health Service on line four, and you look like at Providence, and it looks like they don't have any discounts or allowances, or to me that's saying that they're collecting 100% of whatever services they're providing for that Indian health service, but in other hospitals they have a pretty high percentage that they're giving a discount, and I'm just curious of, you know, why it almost is like 50-50. Could anyone answer that, or if I just dug into a can of worms?
I don't understand
that. I'm asking that. As an example, you said that you provide some services that the Indian Health Hospital cannot, and therefore you're reimbursed, I assume, 100% when you provide that.
In some cases, that's true. In some cases, it's not.
Oh, okay. I was just looking at it. It's like about 50% of the hospitals are saying that they are collecting 100%, and 50% are...
Who else?
50%. Fairbanks Memorial is one. If you look on line four, you know, under their allowance or discounts, they have, what, 700 and I can't remember what it said, $777,000.
I could probably speak to that.
Oh, great. I'm just curious why.
If Dave Mather were here, he could really speak to it. But in terms of Fairbanks, I think it's kind of a unique facility in that there is no Alaska Native Medical Center such as there is in Anchorage for Fairbanks. So IHS beneficiaries use the Fairbanks Memorial Hospital. So there is going to be a larger volume of IHS business in Fairbanks at the hospital. So probably, and they pay for their, a lot of that service out of contract health service money, care money, and they probably negotiate the rate.
That answers my question.
I would like to ask a question on the Medicaid area. I don't know if Jay can answer it or Kim. Is Kim still here?
Yes.
Kim's ignoring us. Just a question on the line two, Medicaid. I just want to be sure I understand. Looking at Providence Hospital, for example, first of all, line 16 shows that revenues at the full charge rate, that full cost to full charge ratio is 69%, about 70%. But if you look at the Medicaid line, you see that Medicaid is paying 51% of net revenues to full charges. So that tells me that Medicaid is not paying the full cost of care, right?
Well, I probably, Jay is on the commission, he could help me with this, but it's a prospective system, and as I think Gary was saying earlier, is that because it's based on cost data from 2 years prior, after over a period of time, it should, if you looked at a five-year period, it should wash. It should be paying cost, at least cost. It's, in fact, in the federal law and under state law, you have to pay a reasonable cost. So it's,
but it's cost
charges and cost being different things.
Right.
No. And I would defer again to Jay really to get into any technical piece of it.
Okay, so cost and charges being different things. So we can look at this and say Medicaid believes that the cost is really only 51.52% of the charge.
Well, again, it's prospective. Again, it's a prospective situation. So if you in 1 year would pay less than, you would catch up with that in a couple of years because you're going based on years prior years cost. It's prospective.
So looking at Petersburg, where Medicaid is paying 95%, 96%, that just happens to be in a, because of the way this is done prospectively or whatever, in a year when it's...
Well, it might have to do with their charge structure. It might be that their charge structure is closer to cost.
So, okay, and look at the bottom line there, I guess it does say that. Cost of charge ratio, 104% for Petersburg. So what does that tell us about what Providence is charging and what their cost is in relationship to what Petersburg is doing? I'm asking that because I don't know what it tells me. But, Larry, what's it tell me?
Sure, but ask your question again. I think I got what Kim was saying, that essentially in terms of looking at sort of the causes of the problem with cost shifting, at least Medicaid is covering it over a period of time. Medicaid is covering the cost of care for its clientele, but not necessarily picking up a portion of the cost shift. You don't recognize uncompensated care in there, do you, Kim?
No.
No.
Well, I guess what tells me is that Petersburg is being paid more. Their charge is greater than their cost. Am I wrong in reading
what
that?
What page is Petersburg on?
It's right before Providence. We're doing this stuff alphabetical. That's why we're picking on these people. But the Petersburg cost-to-charge ratio, Gary, does that mean that they're...
Mr. Chairman, the cost-to-charge ratio is very simply line 12 divided by line 11C. Line 12A divided by line 11C. And you'll see that the cost there is $2,469,069. The total charges for services is $2,356,912. Therefore, the cost for Petersburg was 104% of charges. Now, what's not in that charges for services is the other revenue, the revenue sharing money that Petersburg gets, and the amount for miscellaneous that maybe that's what keeps them from going underwater in calendar 1990. But the fact of the matter is their costs exceed their ordinary charges for services.
Okay, so Petersburg, for example, is charging close to what it actually costs to do business.
Yes.
And now, not knowing what this means, but looking at Providence then, when you look at line 11A, 11C, and 12A, Providence is charging, according to this, 30% more than what it costs to provide the service.
They should have a 30% profit.
That's a good point. Representative Navarre points out that Representative Navarre points out, makes a good point here, that interest expense is the only part of debt service that is included here in operating costs. So if there's any debt service for principal, that's not in that cost number. Dave?
Which may be another good reason for a good
Senator Duncan, earlier you said the ratio of cost to charge implies that Providence is charging 30% more than its cost, and that's a true statement.
That's a true statement?
That's a true statement. Mm-hmm. Now, the real issue, and that's what we're talking about, this de facto tax that we keep coming around to, called cost shifting, the far right-hand corner, the far right-hand line 11, actually shows you how much the hospital collects. So even though we bill $172,000, we only collect $129,000. Some of that's due to uncompensated care, whether you call it bad debt or charity. Some of it is by government regulation. They only pay so much. And so in the final analysis, we collect 75 cents on the dollar, and our costs are 70 cents on the dollar, and we retain 5 cents on the dollar for profit that we reinvest into the property, plant, and equipment and provide new services to the community.
Okay. Without getting into all the accounting things that go on here, if you looked at line 11A, column C, your actual net revenue is $129,810,000. Compare that to line 12A, column A, that's $119,920. That's your excess collections above your operating cost. That doesn't mean that's what, you still got depreciation that's not in that figure. I think that's right. But what it really tells us then is that you're charging 30% more than what it costs to do business because some folks aren't full pay, such as Medicaid, Medicare, other preferred provider arrangements that you might have with, I'm not picking on anybody, but with Blue Cross, for example. Somebody is helping pay for that discount you're giving to the Blue Cross patients or to the other commercial insurance patients who are getting preferred provider arrangements.
That's correct.
Okay, and that's, I guess, what I've always, and I'm not saying that's, I understand how that works, but that's why I think that for the problem with preferred provider arrangements, if you don't do it globally, is you just end up with the cost shift. Certain people, if they have Blue Cross, they're in great shape when they go to Providence, but the folks who don't have, the private payor is paying for it, right? All the rest of us are, in one way or the other. So I'm not trying to
explain that a little bit. I may have been misunderstanding the question. I thought you were talking in a generic sense, revenue deductions, as opposed to preferred provider relationships. Because, as you can see on line 8, there's $975,000 in negotiated savings that we've effected with Blue Cross. In turn for that reduction in price, they've added volume to the hospital that normally would not come. So the measuring the volume that comes into the overall equation in building up our efficiency, because they trade additional volume for price concession, and we don't measure as a financial number how much that added volume costs.
Okay. I admit it's more complicated, but I think the picture is becoming clear. Anyway, David?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess what I would be interested in is kind of winnowing out the things in column B to items that what we can do here would positively affect. You know, for example, lines 8 and 9, the Blue Cross and the commercial insurance, that's $1.2 million. Those seem to me to be basically sale discounts. Mm-hmm. And if I own a car dealership and give a fleet discount, I don't kind of get to put that in as a loss. I mean, that's something that I do. It's a loss leader, like any business. I don't know whether the same thing would apply to Medicare, Medicaid. But that's obviously the biggest chunk. I guess out of the $42 million that's there, it seems to me about all that we can really affect is the 5.9 of bad debt. Because if people had adequate coverage, arguably that wouldn't be there. And I don't know anything else. I mean, I think that's probably an issue that if I were Sister Donna or Charles Stokes or somebody, I don't know that I would want to say that out of 172 million or 119 million, depending upon what number you want to choose, that there shouldn't be some type of charity care there. I don't think that we can eliminate that. I don't think that we ever will. Even if we go unless we go to a universal government paid for system. But even if you take that, that's still $10 million, and that ain't chicken feed, more than I made this week. But as against charges of $172 million or costs of $119 million, we're talking, I guess, a much less significant percentage of the total than I thought we'd be talking about. And I guess that if I miss a point, if there's something else in these spreadsheets that we ought to be focusing on, I'd like to know about it. If we're focusing on this $10 million, lines 1A and 1B, that's good. I mean, at least then we know. But if there's something else here that we can do here that can affect anything below line 1B, I'd like to know what it is so we can focus on it.
Who are you asking it?
Just of anyone, like Gary or Dave or anyone.
Okay. I'd like to say we could do something about lines 2 and 3, but I agree it's unlikely that we'll be able to affect any federal or state changes in Medicare and Medicaid. And under the CHIPRA proposal, essentially all we're trying to address is the line 1 A and B, charity and bad debt.
How about line 10?
Yeah, in line 10. To the extent that that's classified as other than a policy discount or something that we voluntarily do. But I think if we were to focus just on lines 1A and 1B, of roughly $10 million in the case of Providence and the same number in all other facilities, that would be a considerable gain.
Here.
I want to ask that question in an opposite way, and I apologize if I'm redundant on this. I'm just not getting it. Back to line 9. What this is saying to me is that I am one of 37% of the people who walks in your hospital who is paying $800. Is that what this is saying? Or is the percentage against what you have agreed that they should pay? Because if I were a rate-setting person, I would say, why am I paying 99.48% of the charges here and nobody else is? See what I'm saying? I'm trying to get clear in my mind. Is this 100% against the full charge, or is it against what you've agreed that they should pay?
I think that question is essentially what the United States is saying, because we're now faced with increasing or spiraling health care costs as measured by the rate of increase in CPI. And Ford, General Motors, and all the major employers and minor small businesses are saying, enough's enough. We can no longer assume this de facto tax that's built into the healthcare reimbursement system, because we're paying 100%. And naturally, when others like Medicare is only paying 50 cents and Medicaid's paying 50 cents, somebody else is paying. And that's why I was saying earlier, it doesn't affect cost. We just pass it on to others that are able to pay. And yes, the insurance companies, Senator Duncan is very much aware that ends up in the laps of those plans that are able to pay.
understand what you're saying. If I design a catastrophic coverage plan like under CHRPA where there's a $5,000 lifetime max, okay, and that's basically, and I go into the hospital and I'm one of these 37% that's under line 9, okay, and you're charging me to $800 a day, right? You're expecting me to come up with the first $5,000 of that money, okay? But if the insurance company then kicks in the additional amount beyond, let's say, the bill's $10,000, you're saying the insurance company paid 100% of charges, right? The problem is that line 10 is recording that first $5,000 if you collect it. First recording period. And I guess my point is that there's a lot of this is erroneous to me. It shows me nobody is really paying 100%. I just want to make sure I understand it, because as we fashion solutions, I don't want us to be simplistically assuming that everyone in that 37% category is paying their full way, number one, or number two, they're paying too much because they're the only ones paying. And then I'll just shut up.
The figure's misleading, I think, the way it's laid out. I think if you just have to clarify it to understand that the insurance company's paying picking up 99% of what they're expected to, what they've agreed to according to their program.
There are a lot of questions here. Karen just, and I hadn't thought about this, but looking at the proposal you folks put forward with $1,000 deductible, for example, I think that was the basic plan.
$1,000 deductible.
It doesn't necessarily end up in line 10. From what I've been hearing from you and from Garth and others, a lot of that bad debt comes from people who don't pay their deductible. So with a $1,000 deductible, which is pretty high, I'm not sure how much we do finally impact line. Can't read this thing. 1B. I mean, so I think you got to be real careful, and that's why the plan design, and you know, we're going to discuss more in detail later on, but why putting into a statute plan design of $1,000 deductible may not be the smartest thing in the world, because that may not be the plan you want to design. You've got to do a lot of work before you decide if it's $1,000 or if it's $500 or if it's $250. It's kind of like riding a bus, right? You charge them a buck to ride the bus, they'll ride it. You charge them a buck and a quarter, and they won't, and you lose money. So there's a lot of, I think this is, anyway. Jared, Representative Navarro, then. Jared, did you have your hand up too?
Well, I was going to take a run at this one too. This, I think, was something that Larry addressed, I believe, was the October meeting. But if we're looking at, in the case of Providence, a gross debt there of close to around $10 million. But on the other hand, you look at all the people that utilize the system that are not paying their full share, that the net effective debt usually the surviving user's basis is actually pretty close to double in on a per-person basis. And you want to kind of clarify that a little more, Larry, but that was my understanding back when you went through it before, that the debt isn't uniformly distributed amongst all the users.
Jerry, I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part, but I looked back in October, you were saying, you have to look, there are three classes of payers here. There are those that don't pay, that pay something close to full charges, and therefore will pick up or contribute to financing this cost shift in uncompensated care. There are those payers that don't pay full charges but cover their costs. And let's say that Medicaid falls into that category. That is a payer that does not contribute to the problem, but it is a payer that doesn't contribute to the solution. And then you've got a third class of patient whose payments do not cover charges nor the cost of their coverage, and that would be the people without coverage or whatever. In terms of just if I actually think this is helpful that the group has gone through this. If you look again at Providence and you look at items 1A and 1B, bad debt and charity care, that is again on a charge basis, that is close to $10 million there. Understand that $10 million has to be, if the institution is to remain solvent, has to be picked up from some other source. And what I want to make sure that you understand is that for the most part, and Dave, you can help me here, you can skip over the payers listed on lines 2, 3, 4, and 5, to the extent that they are, and I may be off in this, to the extent that they are price setters, and say, Medicare, for example, this is what we pay for this DRG, and that's the ballgame. That $10 million in charges, which according to this is really $7 million in costs, has to be recovered from lines 8, 9, and 10, a much smaller population or a much smaller base, being Blue Cross and the commercials. So it is sort of in terms of, and this is what gets translated into the higher charges, that $10 million or $7 million in unrecovered costs has to get picked up by that sliver of the private pay, who are not price setters but price takers. And again, you know, quick figure would be that probably that uncompensated care in province probably means about a 15% increase in charges to if you were to recover it from those folks. So that's
a good explanation. Representative Navarre, then Dave.
Yeah, I still haven't reconciled the Medicaid and Medicare in the different, looking through the different hospitals, some pay at a much higher rate than Providence and Humana. And I'm just wondering, I couldn't follow, I guess, the prospective billing or whatever, and what that means. Will they pay some of this? Has some of this been billed and just not paid at this point? Or that's just never going to be billed? And if so, is the Medicare system, I know there are some problems with it, but is it so bad that it only pays 50% of what is a reasonable charge?
One way to answer it, if you were to just focus on that line with Medicaid, and depending on around the table whose hat you had on, and if you were to say you're a Medicaid patient, Medicaid would pay $16.5 million. If you were a Blue Cross, Aetna, or Industrial Indemnity, you'd pay $32 million. So when you think about that, whether it's billed or unbilled or paid or unpaid, that's not factored into this. This is purely a matter of services rendered to patients that are called Medicaid patients. And $32 million is what our standard fee that we charge, and Medicaid will pay us $16.5 million, following a prescribed rules and regulations that we all live with. But the difference between those two numbers essentially does get cost-shifted to Blue Cross and Aetna and all the others that are in the system.
So that is your loss leader. Medicaid and Medicare are your loss leaders. You do that even though you're losing, but at Providence, a total of about $26 million a year on that end of it, you continue to do it just because you've agreed to do that.
Dave, before you answer that question, you're not necessarily losing money on those folks. Could you explain that? I mean, you're not getting your full charges, but I think it's real important. You're not necessarily... You're getting your costs covered, as I read it here, or at least for Medicaid. I haven't taken a close look at Medicare.
Right. So in using the cost of charge ratio, that's on line 16, which is 69.5%, and assuming that if everyone incurred costs on an average basis, then you compare that to line 2, the 51.5% is what's being reimbursed, you would conclude that you're not breaking even on that one.
In this year?
Right, in this year. In the case of Medicare, we're reimbursed 62.4%, and our costs are 69%, so we lose 5%. So that's what we have been advocating with the federal and the state, is that the reimbursement rates are not keeping pace with the costs. And so we have gotten to the point where we are losing money. Now, in the initial days of the prospective payment system, it was the opposite, wherein
hospitals were making money on prospective payment, but because of budget-driven constraints, reimbursement has been held back. For example, in 1991, Medicare has increased its payment rates to Providence Hospital by 1.3%. And you've heard what the general inflation has been running, somewhere in the order of 3.5% to 4%. We just completed our Medicaid hearing, and they increased it 4%. So at least the state pays more closely to the true rate of inflation, but the feds do not, because it's budget-driven.
Okay, I'm not sure who was in order here. Representative Barber, do you have a follow-up? You, and then Dave,
yeah.
And then Trish.
I do, because at least for me, just looking at these numbers and going down to line 9, which is, I think probably a lot of that is the state's health care plan. It looks like Medicaid and Medicare are getting a heck of a lot better discount rate than commercial insured are, even though they've got about the same amount of volume that they pay for over the course of the year. And with respect to Medicaid, and especially Medicaid, you know, I watch that budget every year, and I see it going up like $20 to $50 million every year, and if we can't get some type of control on that, you know, we're going to be missing out, I think, on a huge part of our health care budget in the state. So.
Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Dave Wells. I have things to say, I think, about two areas in here. First of all, lines 1A and 1B. I think for our purposes, or at least for my own purposes, I would be hard-pressed to consider the extended charity care problem. That's 2.6% of the $172 million, the total charges, and 3.7% of the $119 million. And Chairman, lend me your calculator, and I've kind of been going through the others. And those percentages basically hold true. And that doesn't seem to me to be an outlandish number. Certainly nothing that calls for a massive change in public policy. That any business, particularly a business that has the job of providing service to the public, gives 2.7% of its gross sales to charity. I mean, that does not seem to me to be a major public policy problem. Secondly, with regard to bad debt, I had a small business before I took this job for 16 years, and if I could have gone through a year where my bad debt was 3.5% of my gross billings or 5% of my actual collections, I would have thrown a party. And any of you who've had businesses in the private sector, I think, would bear that out. And the businesses that I represented had bad debts far in excess of that. And similarly, that number, that percentage, and I don't mean to pick on one facility here, because it seems to hold true throughout the exhibit. That also doesn't call out to me as something that calls for massive change in public policy. It really doesn't. Now, when you get down to lines 2 and 3, you've got